Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news.
Hello, I'm your host, Effie Pilarinou, and today I am delighted to have with us April Rudin, who is the founder and CEO of the Rudin Group, which is a marketing agency specialized in wealth management. And April is the queen of wealth management, an influencer, very well recognized, and an old-time friend, although we haven't seen each other in person in a long time. Welcome, April.
Effie, I'm so flattered. I admire your work, as you know. You have such an interesting point of view and voice in the marketplace. So thrilled to be here today and have a conversation with you.
Thank you very much, April, too. I mean, I'll start with the fact that, you know, you were ahead of the curve in terms of digital and how to have a conversation on digital as a company, as a brand, especially in financial services and specifically in wealth management. So let's go back to when and how you started the Rudin Group. I know that it was born the same year as Bitcoin, 2008, just after the major financial crisis. So it's really, on the one hand, odd that you started then, what led to that. Then on the other hand, it's clear that a lot of innovation happened in that period. So tell us a little bit about that time.
Sure, thank you, Effie. So I had a long career in technology and marketing before I went to financial services. And living in New York, there's really two industries. There's financial services and the garment industry. And I like to buy garments, but I don't necessarily want to work in the garment industry. So I went to work for a friend of mine whose family was credited with inventing multifamily office. And I took a look around, Effie, and this is a few years prior to launching my firm. And I thought, I have never seen such old brands, a lighthouse, a chess piece, a yacht, a compass, oldest iconography you could ever even dream of. These websites and the digital footprint from some of these firms look like they came from medieval times. And I have two Gen Z kids of my own. I read about the wealth transfer, and in my mind, it tied back to something I'd done early in my career. I thought, this is an area really ripe for explosion. So I had this idea of starting a firm that addressed that need, but at the highest level. So ultra high net worth and high net worth investors, being the most sophisticated and being the most discerning in terms of brand. So I went to a friend of mine who ran a trust company in New York, and I told him my idea for a business in 2008, and he told me, you're a really nice girl, April, but you're too old to be an entrepreneur. Banks will never hire outside firms. High net worth people will never be on the internet, and social media is a fad.
Okay, those are three myths that we have to debunk. I mean, exactly. You must have been courageous to stand in front of these three major bombs that this friend of yours sort of served you.
Yes, but then I thought to myself, if this is what this old white guy thinks, then I'm probably onto something good. I also, you mentioned 2008, of course, where 2008 was a very bad year, obviously, for financial services firms. It turned out that I thought to myself, these firms really need to sharpen their messages, sharpen their brands. I came up with this concept of millennializing their brand. So appealing to multi-generations instead of that staid sort of idea of wealthy clients, which is perpetuated by, you know, I don't know who, but I always think about, you know, here in the U.S., and you probably know the Beverly Hillbillies, where you had Mr. Drysdale. He was a private banker serving the Clampett. So, yeah, that old version of wealth needed to change.
Yeah, that segmentation that really existed and persisted for a very long time. And you know, me being in Switzerland here, the hub of private banking and so on, I still see that some of these ways of treating clients or the mindset has not really gone away. It's really segmenting clients by their, I want to say wallet size, but yeah. It's not their wallet size, their account size.
And their age, right?
Their age, yes.
That's a big problem. So many private banks think just because you're a baby boomer, because you're of this age, this is the kind of client service or the kind of products that you're interested in. And that kind of segmentation doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And so many research surveys have proven, whether it's around digital adoption, you know, the older age is very much into digital channels and prefers digital channels. And, you know, we could deep dive on that topic. But I want to go to wealth tech, which, you know, if you look on our beloved, ironically, Twitter, wealth tech is not a hashtag that is trending as much as it deserves. I must admit also that I noticed that people just put hashtags even though they're sharing content that has nothing to do with the hashtag. So, you know, they might be sharing something about AI or cybersecurity or, I don't know, inflation and so on, and they'll slap a fintech hashtag just to you know, be in the conversation. But wealth tech, how do you think of wealth tech as a space, and what sort of subcategories, what do you put under that umbrella when you think of it?
So great question. Let me just back up a little bit to something you said, which is, to me, it's super interesting after being, you know, running my business for 15 years now. I don't understand why wealth tech still feels nascent. It's such a growing area and has so much potential. And, you know, for me, things like payments are version 3.0, 4.0, they're really played out. A lot of these different technologies. If you use Twitter as a barometer, I agree with you. I mean, I used to have a Twitter addiction, I called it, but I'm certainly breaking my addiction on that. And I think a lot of it becomes exactly like you said, just hashtags trying to get retweets, which I don't even understand what that means, but that obviously is a subject for another day. So regarding wealth tech, it's such a new field. And I always think of, there was an American bank robber, Effie, back in, you know, the days of the Wild West, and his name was Willie Sutton. And he was a very famous bank robber because he robbed so many banks and made so much money. And so somebody asked him once, Willie, why do you rob the banks? And his answer was, because that's where the money is. And so I always think about that with wealth tech and wealth, like, that's where the money is, people. If there's anything that people take,
that's
away,
where the real money is, the real assets.
Yes, the real money, both in terms of firms that have money, clients that have money, investments into fintech is a huge area, direct investing for wealthy families. So if there's anything that listeners or can take away from this, it's take a slide over and take a look at wealth tech. But So I think the whole idea of wealth tech is something that's really important to segment outside, or segregate, I was going to say, outside of fintech, because fintech is such a broad category. Yeah. And can mean so many different things. So where wealth tech could be a subcategory, it really is its own industry. So for me, it's sort of two prongs. The one prong in wealth tech is those technologies that automate financial advice. So that can be, you know, a broad range of different kinds of technologies, which we'll talk about. And then the second category that people is often not included in that is an area of wealth tech, meaning the client service digitalization of that is hyper important. And I don't know that everyone sees those two prongs, but many times, including the last time we saw each other, wealth tech sort of gets bucketed into robo-advisor, whatever that is. So
yeah, clearly there was an era, I would say, you know, around 2015, 2018, where wealth tech was thought of only robo-advisors, robo-this and robo-that and so on, and all the fights between the Betterment and the wealth fronts of the world, and then the incumbents that got into robo services and so on. And as you said, wealth tech is so much broader. I don't know what it is, why it's not getting that bandwidth that it needs.
I'm just going to ask one question. One other piece to put on that is probably compliance. So a lot of people in wealth management, if you think about why it's not on Twitter or something like that, a lot of people are still under the misconception that they're not allowed to be on these social platforms, and then they don't know what to say because they don't want to be salesy, because most financial advisors don't see themselves as salespeople. And so that, I think, creates a little rub down.
Yeah. That's a great point, April. I've spoken to asset managers and also to firms that create financial products, whatever wrappers they are, exchange traded notes, ETFs, funds, and so on. And as you said, they are not clear as to what they can and should do. And also the benefit, and because they don't know how to do it, they are, you know, sitting on the guidelines or doing very minimal things compared to, as you said, the payments space or the retail banking space, which is, you know, much more lower hanging fruit and is not so much concerned about compliance and fiduciary duties and conflicts and so on. And we're seeing that, you know, with grown-up fintechs that have gone down the public route, how they've changed their behavior, their public behavior, right? So what is in the wealth tech space? Shall we first talk about what is exciting and frustrating for you? Or do you want, shall we talk about personalization and hyper-personalization? What do you prefer?
Well, I think that we should talk about what's exciting and frustrating, because that really ties into the personalization. So for me, the exciting part is that it's all green fields. It's all white space. There really are no brands, and there really are very few offerings that are differentiated and are obvious to ultra high net worth and high net worth individuals if they're taking a look at which firms they want to work with. So most firms are still, from a marketing standpoint, not adopting voice of the client. The voice of the customer just isn't there. It's all about them. And so in order to really attract end investors and those serving them, they have to really change into voice of the customer and make it all about them and not all about us.
So they're still with a push model, is what you're saying?
Yes. So if you take a look at the messaging that many firms use, it's laundry lists of here's what we do. We can do this. We can do that. We do this. We do that. Here are all of our qualifications. We've been doing it for so many years. But there's really not a message that translates that into client or customer benefits. And so that really is the first step here, is for firms to realize that they need to take the messages that they put out there and make them more for public consumption. And the second piece that really needs to change is the idea of client experience. So for most wealth management firms, the idea of client experience, we talked about that for a moment, might be inviting somebody into their mahogany conference room and serving them tea in China cups and pedi-fours right on the table. Swiss chocolate, yes.
Exactly. High-end Swiss chocolates.
High-end Swiss chocolates, exactly. But the truth is that that's really not the face of wealth, right? And that is, could be the age of wealth, but it's not the face of wealth. And so you made a comment earlier too about the ability or the want for digital adoption. And study after study shows that it's really ultra high net worth baby boomers that have the highest appetite for digital. And why? It's not because they're dumb. They don't understand digital. It's not because they don't have a device. It's not because, they haven't made fortunes in different areas of business. And so I'd really like to, get that misconception out of people's heads. It's really not just millennials that have an appetite for digital. So the idea of client experience, that's the point I'm getting to, the idea of client experience is really important and can be a huge differentiator from the first emotive website that you go to that makes you feel something instead of learn something, like we've been in business since, 1842, yep. Something that makes you understand more about the firm and the DNA of that firm that you're working with.
Interesting. So the shift hasn't happened. I mean, maybe it's starting, and I guess this lack of a focus on a pull model rather than a push model, is that also in the way of really delivering personalized financial services, either on the advice or the product side?
It hasn't really made it in yet. So that's why I wanted to talk about that first. So I just saw a funny meme that said, our idea of personalization is a personalized email where it says, "Dear Effie," right? So that, that level of personalization is not really what we're talking about here. So that's where technology can really deliver personalized experiences, personalized portfolios at scale, and then personalized advice beyond investment advice for wealthy families that are really looking for that. So that really is personalization.
I mean, in the US, I've been hearing a lot about direct indexing, which obviously is customization of portfolio holdings. In your mind, is that really personalization for the customers? Is it really getting in the real assets? Because I've been following and hearing a lot of independent SaaS providers for direct indexing and some acquisitions from big firms, be it Mary Lynch or Bank of America and so on. But has it reached the customer, so to speak, or not yet?
So that's a great question. As usual, Effie, you ask great questions and get to the heart of the matter. So technology is certainly available for some of these things, for example, direct indexing. But how does an advisor implement that with their clients? So one of the things we do is we create what we call an advisor toolkit that is a B2B2B2C model. So what that does is help large-scale organizations, some of the ones you're talking about, train financial advisors or teach them how to use this one area of personalization, but also how to introduce it to clients. because if they're not clear on
the benefits,
right, then there's no way their clients can be cognizant even of the benefits of something like direct indexing. So I think there's a lot of education, and it all centers around the financial advisor. And here in the US, as well as globally, I know it's pretty similar, the average age of a financial advisor is about 60. Mm-hmm. And so, not to say that they are not computer literate, but more to say that they are used to behaving and running their business in a certain way. They haven't had technology. They've been working on referrals from the golf club. And so the world has really changed, and those people will be aging out, and there are not enough younger people going into financial advice, financial planning to really make up for that gap.
So just to take a look at, especially in the US, where we have all these firms that are essentially tech platforms serving the financial advisors, whether it's the big names, the Fidelities, the Merrill Lynches of the world, or so on, or other firms. And what you're describing is that the technology is there, but the adoption from the financial advisors is not really there because of a culture and mindset and all what we discussed.
And so they're overwhelmed with having to get new clients, serve their existing clients. There's a lot on their plate. And so finding the time and the ability to do that, especially
in an upskill.
Yes, exactly. Now, in the US, we have the entity called the RIA, the Registered Investment Advisor. And those are more entrepreneurial people, more business oriented people. So many times you might find these firms more focused in on business development or marketing rather than, you know, bogged down with operations. So that's an important piece to understand in this market.
Yeah, I mean, if from here in Switzerland, I understand that the so-called private bankers, that's what we call, you know, what you call the advisors over in the US, they're bogged down with a lot of administrative work instead of spending time with their clients. And even though a lot of digitization here has happened in terms of how content is distributed to clients, focused in, you know, the omni-channel distribution of content and doing it in a compliant way, and then taking it to the next level where it is somehow matched to the interests of the clients. But that's only the part, the beginning of the process, right?
Yes.
And even that is not complete.
No, 100%. And that's not even personalized, right? They may have a body of content that their firm has provided to them or that they've purchased. And so it is not customized to their client at all. In fact, you know, in the US, we've had a lot of regulatory changes on retirement. And I just received communication from my own financial advisor that was not good. That was such a boilerplate email with boilerplate links that it just makes you, with a replay to a webinar that I could go listen to learn more about my own retirement. That level of personalization just isn't going to cut it.
Correct. Correct. It isn't going to cut it. And we haven't even touched on what's going on in private markets and in investing in private markets, because all that we're talking about is pretty much, you know, financial advisors are mostly focused in public markets and maybe, you know, bond markets too. But what about private markets and the innovations there?
So that's a huge growing area of business, particularly given market volatility, you know, in the equities market. So heretofore, many wealthy people have had their financial advisors But for direct and private investing, they've sort of done it on their own. And that's outside the purview of financial advisors. And today, there are different platforms like Case or iCapital that bring private investments, alternatives to the financial advisors, so they can in turn bring them to their clients. But the very same thing exists in private markets, where most or many or some, right, financial advisors are not comfortable recommending or understanding these private placements. And in fact, their clients might know more about it than they do, because they might have more experience. So we're at an inflection point, I feel like, and those platforms that I mentioned have their own training to really try to help advisors almost catch up with investors. So it's a little bit of a mismatch there. But certainly, you know, especially given volatile markets, people are looking for some balance with private placement.
100%. I mean, I'm excited in that area about tokenization for the reason of the fact that it will make it more accessible in terms of being able to fractionalize these investments. So even a high net worth individual could construct a more diversified portfolio, you know, even if somebody's allocating 5 million to private markets, which already is a big amount if you think of, you know, private markets being 20% of a portfolio, right? And then you, if you have tokenized private securities, you could really do diversification. Otherwise, with the denominations today, you could only get into very few deals and have a lot of concentration risk. But as you said, you know, we're very far away, and especially in the US with the lack of regulation of tokens. Yes. And which leads also to the fact that cryptocurrencies are also under the alternative asset class. And I'm sure there, again, financial advisors can't really serve their clients, and probably the clients are educating the financial advisors. Is that the case from your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question and a lot to unpack there, obviously, Effie. So I started looking at Bitcoin, I would say at least 10 or 11 years ago. And the idea of it being an asset class had honestly never really occurred to me. I thought of the term cryptocurrency as bad as it is, because who wants crypto? That sounds like something kind of crazy already.
Creepy.
Exactly. It's really poorly named. But the idea of digital currency and digital money was something that really appealed to me, and something that, again, just to go back to what I was talking about before, the ability to really sort of millennialize your practice. It was, you know, trying to be ahead of the curve, which I do, and try to really, you know, prompt other people in wealth management to be thinking ahead of their clients instead of running to keep up with their clients. So Bitcoin pretty quickly turned from being, you know, currency, right, an alternative currency. And that was something I could really understand, because whoever gave my kids cash, I didn't give my kids cash. I don't know about you, but I could definitely understand the appeal of digital money, especially, you know, denominations and so on. That made sense to me. But pretty quickly, Bitcoin turned into an asset class. And I think that's what most people, many people, didn't really understand. And then layer on top of that, the idea of trading versus investing in something and being unregulated and not enough knowledge, plus a lot of, I'll say this, testosterone pumping up Bitcoin. And, you know, that's sort of a recipe for disaster right there. It was interesting. I was at an event a few weeks ago, and I heard the crypto dad, who's a former FTC chairman, CFTC chairman, talk about it. And he said his idea was, the reason why he got the moniker of crypto dad was because he said there were no adults in the room. There were just kids in cryptocurrency talking about it that had no experience, didn't understand regulation. And so it just looked like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And look what has happened today. But, you know, you've been at the forefront in terms of digital, definitely. And it's clear to me, especially after Davos and listening to some of the people discussing about our digital future and what is money and Web3, it's becoming clear to me this interaction between media and money and you know, all our world. There's this interactivity. It's not separate, and we are in the midst of it. So it's kind of difficult to understand or to see where we're going. But we understand that there's all this fusion, if you want. And I want to bring up and celebrate the fact that you are a Forbes contributor and you write in Forbes your insights. And I know that you've been preaching digital marketing and digital personalization 10 years ago when nobody sort of knew what this was all about and what to do with it in finance. So what's your feeling going forward, where we are at today with all this craze around the metaverse, chat GPT, you know, tokenization, cryptocurrencies, everything's, you know, it seems like it's raining wild, crazy ideas, and maybe some of them will stick. Maybe, I don't know. So what's your feeling?
So a great question again. You know, not much has changed over the 15 years. I have also 10 years worth of blogs on Huffington Post that for me are really interesting just to go back and see how things were and what I thought of different ideas, particularly social media and Bitcoin and some of these topics that are now really coming to the forefront. But I recently read that PwC called wealth management the slowest industry in the world or something like that.
No, there's insurance that's slower, I think.
And well, insurance to me is faster because they're salespeople. Those people know that they're salespeople. So sales enablement, digitalization, leads, like from a marketing standpoint, they are adopters and they move on that. The products are a different story. And obviously, many people in insurance agents really don't have relationships with their clients, right? They're sort of one and done. They sell a policy and they're out. But it's really all of those things, the metaverse, Web3, you know, and so on, that really give a lot of excitement for me in terms of wealth management, because you have a huge growing wealth industry, as we're talking about, and wealthy industry with assets to deploy. And then you've got this technology that's sort of waiting to be applied, or, you know, the application of it needs to be
to experiment and innovate. It's yes. Ready to explore.
Exactly. And I feel like clients are interested in it. In fact, we saw with Bitcoin, you know, most clients went to their advisors for information on Bitcoin, but the advisors were not allowed by their organizations to even educate or talk about it, let alone invest in it, right? So that's a missed opportunity. So I feel like there's a real opportunity, education, get closer, bringing this information to clients for wealth management firms and asset management firms in the future to really connect with their clients, whether they're retail clients or institutional clients. There's a huge learning curve here, and someone needs to jump in and help people get up to speed with neutral knowledge, right? Not something that is product-based. Yeah.
It's interesting what you say, April, because you're saying that the financial advisor should be able to educate, you know, ahead of the investment. It's not that they should only be able to educate once the investment is available and regulated and so on. They should really be looking into what's coming up and educating their clients, and they're not able to do that and not willing to do that. So you think ChatGPT or these kinds of natural language processing models are going to have an impact on digitizing advice finally? And part of advice is education. It's kind of the first step.
Yeah, so I think probably the easiest use case for most people to understand about ChatGPT is creating content, right? So I think there is an opportunity for wealth management firms and others to create, you know, baseline content, but be able to do it at scale and be able to do it in some personalized way, which ChatGPT will allow them to do. However, how will that content be validated, verified, reviewed for through compliance? You know, all of these other steps are really pretty far in terms of distant future, because as we talked about today also, many people are not even using LinkedIn, or they're blocked, or they don't know what content they can use for LinkedIn. So the ability to leverage other platforms that could be more far-reaching is somewhat in the distant future, unfortunately. And hopefully there are firms working on that, but it really needs to come from a risk, compliance, and regulatory point of view. And at first that might be frustrating for many in the advice industry, but the truth is it's, you know, customer, no matter how, it is outdated sometimes, many of the laws, but the idea is to really protect end investors from bad information or wrong information on different topics. So there is that downside to ChatGPT that's definitely there.
Yeah, it seems clearly that as we improve all these technologies, we are also facing a larger misinformation and trust issues out there, and especially when tools like ChatGPT are released in the public, it's clear that then we'll need another, I don't know, whole ecosystem of yes, companies that are doing what you said, verifying, checking, adding compliance layers, and, you know, all that. So it's like an open can of, I don't want to say worms, but it's opening a whole new possibility. But we have to be careful about it and not go crazy.
Yeah. On top of that, another area, and this can be a talk for a different day, is just the whole idea of RegTech, which is really also advancing in terms of AI. So RegTech's ability to read that content and to flag different pieces of the content and then to learn from, you know, some of the minds in compliance, I think, is also on the horizon. So that's hopeful, right? And RegTech is obviously more reliable and even more compliant sometimes than individual people that you might have reading over or interpreting things. So that's another big area of growth is RegTech. Obviously, that's the underpinnings of our financial services system.
100%, and a very big part of wealth and asset management. And if we think of cross-border RegTech needs and so on, it's just amazing what how complex our system is. And as we innovate further with these tokenizations, with more access to private investing, with in general offering, democratizing and giving more access, we need even more RegTech tools and even more technology to help us really do this in a proper way that protects then the consumer, clearly.
One only needs, I don't know if you've seen the Netflix series on Madoff, but it certainly, it's frightening, really. I mean, as the original, right, and supreme social networker, yeah, you know, Bernie Madoff was able to really leverage all of his social networks and one of the things I saw, I think it was in there or I'd read, is up to one third of people in Palm Beach, Florida had invested with Bernie Madoff, but yet no one had diligenced him. And in fact, if anybody asked any questions, he would try to return back the money and say, okay, you've got questions about us, take it back. You know, and then people would say, no, we don't want to redeem. Like, please, please. And so that idea of scarcity, that whole idea, it seemed very relevant today when you think about also Bitcoin. Like, there's so much FOMO, fear of missing out, that people have. And sometimes that overtakes them with their own sensibility.
100%. And the social networks are amplifying this FOMO. No doubt about it. And it's very difficult to imagine how that can be regulated verified whether it has any basis or not. I mean, I often these days see news and I, you know, read news, and some of them I have to double check and Google and see if they're true, because they seem so true. And then, you know, they're not true at all. It's just amazing.
Right. Well, there's no verification on Twitter, just to circle back to the way we started. There's no verification. Everybody is a reporter. If they've got a camera, they can report on anything. And everyone's allowed, right, to publish whatever they want and let the buyer beware. So that really creates a need for more reg tech and for people and for the advice. And I don't mean investment advice. I mean, just general financial services advice that financial advisors can bring to their clients.
And, you know, April, when I started my career on Wall Street in the 90s, when I was 3 years old, right? It was all, I mean, if you think of it, the business was all about proprietary asymmetric information and proprietary trading, access to information, models, and so on. And now, fast forward, we're talking, you know, what is it, 30 plus years, where we are living in a world of democratizing everything. Aladdin is nearly open source or whatever. It's out there as a service. Goldman Sachs has given a lot of their analytics open source, and so on. But is the world really more democratized if we don't know what is true out there, and we have to double verify, and people are investing because some YouTuber or TikToker or whatever, you know, is saying this and that and the other, and they've got millions of followers? It's kind of a scary sort of one extreme. And then the other extreme of not democratization in the real sense, but really chaos and not knowing what is good and how to curate what is out there.
Yeah, I mean, in the U.S., the Accredited Investors Act, which is over 70 years old, came up with the idea of an accredited investor, one being able to invest in private placements, as someone with a threshold of having a certain asset size and income size. But it's not like, you know, Kim Kardashian is equal to Warren Buffett, even though they're both wealthy people. So that really demonstrates that there's no democratization. You could, you know, be much more educated and have no assets and not than somebody who, you know, potentially has you know, a large portfolio and money to lose. The idea of protecting people from themselves, right, is a smart one, except that you could certainly go to the racetrack, you could go to Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, you could go to the equities market and lose everything also.
Commodities futures is the best place to lose money.
So that whole idea is really debunked also. So I think that, you know, just to sort of maybe wrap it up and put a pin in it, Effie, I think we can and should look forward to better and more personalized reg tech, so regulations that protect people, that people understand, personalization in terms of financial advisors, private bankers, understanding more about the client experience that they want their brands and their firms and themselves to be able to deliver, and then the end investor and client who is educating themselves and becoming even more sophisticated as we speak. So all of this needs to catch up with what regular people are reading and learning.
April, thank you so much. And please tell us when you write on Forbes, where people can follow you. I know you're on LinkedIn more than Twitter, but what about your writing on Forbes?
Yes. So if you subscribe to my newsletters, you can follow me on Forbes.com. Just search for April Rudin. I also publish quite a bit on LinkedIn, as you mentioned, LinkedIn newsletter called The Rudin Report, and Twitter in my spare time because I still like it a little bit. I find it interesting. So thank you very much, Effie.
Thank you very much, April, for being with us.
Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter at @Irish_TechNews, on Facebook, facebook.com/Irish Tech News, on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News, on Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie, and on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.